It's 6 after 9, and you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, and for Kathleen Dunn today. We call our 9 o'clock hour on Mondays All Things Political, so we'll do that today. We'll review the political news of the week and weekend and give you a chance to put in your 2 cents worth as well, and you should start dialing right now because we're going to take calls as soon as we get some. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you would prefer to send an email, the address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. My guest this morning is Gloria Teuvold, a professor of political science and chair of the Department of Politics, Law, and Justice at the University of Wisconsin-Superior, and is the person who is most responsible for whatever it is I know about state and local government. Good morning, Gloria, and happy Memorial Day.
Happy Memorial Day to you, too, John.
Well, let's start with, the big one. President Obama is supposed to be very close to announcing his nominee for the High Court. The popular wisdom is that it will be a woman, and some say it may even be a lesbian. Who is your money on?
Well, I think Sotomayor has been talked about by a lot of people. She's already a sitting judge. She's a Hispanic. When President Obama talks about a candidate with some compassion, she grew up in public housing in New York and so forth. So, she seems to be a fairly likely person. Another one, I can't remember her name right off the top of my head, but has taught alongside Barack Obama at the University of Chicago Law School. But he might surprise us and choose a white male.
Well, the Democrats in Colorado want him to pick Ken Salazar.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I'm sure people in Michigan want Jennifer Granholm and so forth. So there's quite a variety of individuals who have been mentioned. But I think we have to remember this is all guessing at this point.
Well, yeah. Until the nominee is actually announced, I mean, you're right. But that's why we're here. Otherwise, it would be a very short program today. Already some discussion in the Senate about a possible filibuster if the Republicans don't like the candidate particularly. There was some reaction to, as you referred to it, the president looking for someone with some compassion and who would have some empathy from the bench. And that sparked some reaction in the United States Senate and the promise of a possible filibuster if they think that the person isn't going to make their decisions based on the constitutions and the constitution and law and so forth. Do you think at this point, is that mostly just posturing, or is whoever Barack Obama sends up to the Senate going to face a tough time there?
Well, I think that he's pretty sure that he's going to get whoever he wants. What's happening right now, I believe, is a lot of posturing. And, of course, the Republican Party right now is kind of struggling for an identity. And so a lot of folks within the Republican Party are trying to find an issue on which they can rally their troops. And so at least some of the Republicans say, well, this, we know we can't win, but this is one of the things that we can rally Republicans on and help to identify what it is that the Republican Party stands for. Of course, there's an ongoing debate about what the Republican Party stands for, so there will be different factions of Republicans.
Well, let's just quickly go through the short list. You mentioned Sonia Sotomayor, who is a graduate of Yale Law School. There's also mentioned is Diane Wood. She's on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. She was a Clinton appointee. Elena Kagan, who was confirmed as Solicitor General just this past March. Let's see. Jennifer Granholm, you mentioned her as well, who was elected Governor of Michigan in 2002. Janet Napolitano, who is currently President Obama's Homeland Security Secretary. Leah Ward Sears, who is serving as a Chief Justice in the Georgia Supreme Court. That's kind of an interesting one. Maybe someone from the South might help out a little there. Pam Carlin, who is the Stanford law professor, previously taught at Virginia School of Law and served as a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun. Kathleen Sullivan is a constitutional law scholar and currently teaches at Stanford Law School and is the one candidate in this bunch who is openly gay, I believe. And Kim Wardlaw, who is serving as a judge in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Not a guy in sight here.
No, and again, this isn't a list that came from the White House. This is a list that the press has developed over time.
So. Yeah, this one happened to be developed by Nina Totenberg at National Public Radio.
I thought of course, since... you know, Nina does keep it close ear to the ground in Washington, but the again, it's not necessarily going to be someone on that list. But, you know, we're hoping to find out tomorrow.
It'll serve as a grist for the news mill for the rest of the week.
Right. One of the things that cable news, of course, has to do is keep generating stories. So they've generated a big story about who it can conceivably be without necessarily having a firm grasp of who is really being considered. So.
Well, you know, it's speculation about Supreme Court nominees is sort of is almost a sport. I would imagine that someplace there are some odds and and a way for a person to place a small wager.
Right. And I do think that people are focusing on various kinds of demographic characteristics of the candidates and possibly even, you know, previous associations, but one of the things I learned early on in school was if you try to predict the behavior of a future Supreme Court appointee, you'd best look at the books on his shelves or her shelves rather than maybe even the decisions that have been made or the previous political positions that have been taken.
Well, a lot of Supreme Court nominees, once they become justices, have made decisions which seemed rather at odds with their previous history, and Earl Warren would be perhaps one of the best examples of that.
Right, and of course, Earl Warren was appointed by Eisenhower. He had been Republican governor of California. No one quite expected that. Another one, of course, is David Souter, who's being replaced at this point. You know, a Republican appointee again, who turned out to be very much a part of the liberal wing of the Supreme Court.
All right. Well, it doesn't look like anybody wants to call in and talk about the Supreme Court this morning, so maybe you and I are the only ones interested in handicapping that thing. We'll let's move on. National security was in the spotlight again last week and over the weekend. President Obama and former Vice President Dick Cheney traded speeches on the subject on Friday. The left not too happy with President Obama on some of these issues, the closing of Guantanamo and some of the positions that he's adjusted since he became president. The Republican Party trying to play to something that has been a strength for them in the past, with Dick Cheney raising the specter of terrorists carrying nuclear weapons into the United States and playing the fear card again. What do you think about all of this?
I think this is again another example of some interesting posturing. The left of the Democratic Party was obviously getting more and more upset with Obama in terms of release of documents and things of this sort, and not moving quickly enough on Guantanamo, saying, you know, that he was moving more in the direction of President Bush. Former Vice President Cheney, of course, took a position that basically said he should go the other way, yet was claiming that, you know, there's this much danger with the position he's taking, but also saying, we need those documents. This kind of neutralized the left as far as Obama was concerned. Suddenly, the left to be arguing for the release of some of these documents and so forth was supporting the Cheney position. And so in some very peculiar way, Cheney actually helped Obama with the left, dealing with the left of the Democratic Party. I think it's unfortunate that Cheney was bringing up the fear comments and so forth, or fear feelings. And, you know, I guess I have some question about how justified they are. There's also something very peculiar going on in the U.S. Senate in particular with the vote on funding for the change in Guantanamo, or the gradual closing of Guantanamo. There is suddenly this sudden fear of, well, where are we going to put these people? You know, they're going to be in the United States, and all of a sudden we're going to be in danger. And yet, as Obama rightly points out, if we put them into federal maximum security prisons, no one has actually ever escaped those places.
Well, yeah, and I'm trying to figure out where this is coming from. There was a story, and I'm trying to remember if I read this in a magazine or if I saw it on television. It's all kind of a blur right now. There's a small community in Montana where they built this big prison expecting to house a whole bunch of inmates, and it's empty.
Yes.
And some people out there want to bring the Guantanamo detainees there. Of course, one of the senators from Montana says that is not going to happen.
Yes, in fact, I've heard that both senators from Montana say that's not going to happen. And I really think that senators know better than to be so afraid of having these detainees in their state. So there's this strange kind of thing going on there of not being certain how the public is going to respond to some of these things, particularly when you raise the fear. Fear is a very strange thing in politics, where we seem to sometimes set aside our rational thoughts when the emotion associated with fear takes
over.
Well,
I heard it put this way: individuals are smart, people are stupid.
That's probably the case.
I didn't make that up, but I don't remember who said it.
Much has been written, actually, about the use of emotion in politics, and I think this is something that we've used very effectively, particularly after 9/11, where, of course, you had fears that had been, justified in the sense of something coming to fruition there. We do react, I think, sometimes with our gut instead of our brain in some of these circumstances.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we have some callers who want to talk about this Cheney-Obama kerfuffle, and we'll take those calls in just a couple of moments. This is All Things Political for Memorial Day, the 25th of May, 2009. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 20 after 9. I'll tell you what, if you like the topic of birding, this is your morning, because it looks like we're going to have a couple of hours of it. We have a program at 10 o'clock this morning with Olivia Gentile, who is the author of Life List, A Woman's Quest for the World's Most Amazing Birds. Very interesting story about bird enthusiast Phoebe Snetsinger. That's coming up next hour. And then, as you just heard Jim Packard talk about, after 11, Jim Packard sitting in for Larry Mueller is going to be talking with some veteran bird watchers. So I guess you could say that this morning the Ideas Network is for the birds. This hour it's All Things Political for this Monday. My guest is Gloria Teuvel, a professor and chair of the Department of Politics, Law, and Justice at my alma mater, the University of Wisconsin Superior. Let's take a call from Stephen in Madison. Stephen, good morning. Happy Memorial Day.
Yeah, okay, Munson, let's test your theory of people stupid, individuals smart. Let's remember that Norman Mineta, the former Secretary of Transportation, testified to the commission that Cheney, in that bunker beneath the White House that morning in 9/11, was giving orders to allow some incoming missile to hit the Pentagon. Cheney was involved in 9/11.
Okay, I think I've heard that story before. Let's go to Barbara from Waupaca. Oops, we lost Barbara. Barbara, if you'll call back, that'd make my day. Well, you know, every time that we have a program and there's some reference to terrorism or 9/11, we still get calls from people who talk about various conspiracy theories about the government blew up its own buildings and so forth. Well, I don't even know what to say about that, so we'll move on. One of the things that came up over the weekend, by the way, if people want to call in and actually seriously discuss the issue of national security, we'll take some more calls on that. But in the meantime, I want to move to something else as long as we're still waiting. Let me give the phone numbers again, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. It's good just about anywhere you can get this program, although I'm told that this phone number does not work in Australia. So if you're in Australia, you'll have to send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. Again, 800-486-8655. And your chance to get on the program has never been better. All right, now, we had a little dust-up between a number of Republicans about who is a Republican. I don't know if you saw the article in the Rolling Stone that came out a week or so ago about, it was titled The GOP Jihad, but it certainly looks as though the Republicans have been purging their ranks of those they don't feel are conservative enough. And Arlen Specter bolted to the Democratic Party rather than face a Republican primary in his own state, Gloria. But one of the things that happened over the weekend was the question over whether or not Colin Powell is a Republican. What do you think? Is he a Republican?
I believe Colin Powell is a Republican, and he is taking, I think, the more moderate position. One of the difficulties that we have in American political parties is that many, many people want to have ideologically based parties that are clearly distinct from one another and take more specific, more extreme positions. The problem is in a two-party system. You can't get elected that way. And so what Colin Powell is arguing is that we have to be, you know, more inclusive as Republicans, whereas as Cheney and Limbaugh and people of this sort want more ideological purity. If we had a multi-party system, I think ideological purity would be a more possible option. And, you know, of course, we have additional political parties. But given the structure of government that we have, which is single-member district plurality kinds of systems, third parties are really at a disadvantage. So when they come up with some idea that seems to be popular, the major political parties simply take it from them.
Well, it's as I have observed it. It seems to me that even if, let's say, your party gets into power and you've got this pure ideology, and you try to govern using purely ideological thinking, is that even possible? I'll give you. Here's my example: the Soviet Union. Another government based completely on ideology didn't work. I think there are a lot of other examples like that of governments set up based on ideology rather than, and I'll contrast this with, say, a government that is run based on pragmatism or what works. What do you think?
I think that the Soviet Union, first of all, I would argue for public consumption had an ideology that they tried to pass in certain ways, but it was still a totalitarian government, which is not what communist ideology would suggest. And so, the question is, if you have a purely ideological kind of government, can you rule without excessive force? I think if you look at many of the countries that today are trying to be ruled by certain religious beliefs, there too, you know, unless you have a completely homogeneous population, you're going to have to force some people to abide by that. So in an ideal world, you would have everyone saying, this is a wonderful idea, in which case it wouldn't matter too much what kind of leader you had, because everybody agrees that, you know, with this ideology. People don't come that way.
Well, let's we've got Barbara from Waupaca back again, so let's see if I can get her on the air this time without punching the wrong button. Barbara, good morning, and happy Memorial Day.
Hello.
Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Yes, I was calling because I did want to speak about the Cheney national security situation. And
go ahead.
I really think that the press is serving the public rather poorly, and that this is a good point to demonstrate this. When they take, and I can't remember exactly which papers, I think it was the Washington Post, possibly the New York Times, and put the pictures of a sitting president and a private citizen right next to each other, and they really were building this up, and it almost made it seem as though they almost were speaking at the same event. And when a person whom I admire greatly, who is Ben Marins, and I think he's a stellar radio host, but he even started his radio hour with audio clips from President Obama, immediately followed by a clip from Mr. Cheney, almost as though they had been debating. And to me, it would have been more honest to run President Obama's clip or run the picture of Mr. President Obama, and then in the body of the of any news article, if they want to add it, or in the program later mention, Dick Cheney was speaking at this thing and said that, said thus and such. But to take a person who basically was publicly silent and reclusive when he was in office, and to now have him on every talk show, every, you know, news outlet possible, I just wonder either what kind of hold he has over the news media, or I think that this is bad reporting. It's good for ratings possibly, but it's not serving the public in their need to know information, prioritizing that.
Gloria, what do you think?
Well, I do think that Barbara has a very good point here, and I do criticize media quite often in terms of wanting to almost encourage or portray conflict, and I do think that has something to do with ratings. That when you have conflict,
I'm shocked to hear you say that. I'm shocked.
Perhaps you shouldn't be. So you set it up as a conflict, and Barbara's quite correct. Cheney was very silent while he was in office, and now he's being portrayed on an equal footing with the current president of the United States.
Well, it was, they were speaking on basically the same subject on the same day, and I believe they were even speaking in the same city. That's just too much to resist for any kind of news organization.
And the Cheney piece, well, I believe Cheney had scheduled the talk first. Obama then, you know, scheduled the talk, but Cheney waited until the exact moment when Obama was through speaking, and then gave his speech. So they, you know, both of them, I think, were complicit in this notion of being back to back. With Cheney, I think one of the interesting things too is that Cheney's audience here is the American Enterprise Institute, which is a very, very conservative think tank. And so, you know, he was speaking to a particularly narrow people with a narrower viewpoint, and whereas Obama was speaking more to the nation. But Cheney was silent before, and some reporters, I think it was David Brooks, have raised the interesting concept that if you look at Cheney's power in the Bush administration that he was losing the argument on terror and Guantanamo and issues like this toward the end of the administration, that other forces in the administration, President Bush had already said that he wanted to close Guantanamo. President Bush had been moving more in the direction of Obama, and that Cheney was losing that argument.
I think it's interesting that it wasn't that long ago that Republicans were telling Dick Cheney to be quiet.
Yes, he is not viewed as the best spokesperson if you look at his approval rating. But I also think he's trying to save positions for posterity, that this has to do with long-term reputation of Dick Cheney as a vice president.
Well, he was one of the people who was speculating whether or not Colin Powell was still a Republican. Rush Limbaugh actually wants him to leave the party. Tom Ridge, by the way, says that Rush Limbaugh is too shrill. So, you know,
well, Rush Limbaugh is an entertainer. He plays up the conflict. He does it from a very, very conservative point of view. In fact, I think Rush Limbaugh the other day had said that he was resigning his position as leader of the Republican Party, to which, of course, he has never been elected. this is the partisan game. The partisan game is the Democrats want someone like Limbaugh or even Cheney to be viewed as a spokesperson for the Republican Party because that actually helps the Democratic Party. And so the more Cheney starts speaking out like this and so forth, it's actually playing right into the hands of Democratic Party strategists.
Well, over the last 30 or 40 years, both parties have shown themselves completely capable of forming circular firing squads. So it should be interesting.
Usually that's a trait reserved for Democrats, but they've
learned a few tricks there, too, I think, speaking as an independent. But I tell you what, let's take some more calls because, amazingly enough, it's Memorial Day, and yet we have full phone banks. Yay. Let's go to Jenny in Green Bay next. Jenny, thanks for calling.
Hi. I got to make this quick. I just got to work. I was just wondering about the popular opinion disparity between, like, what's going on with national security versus me as somebody who's, just slowly Joe Blow, the American person, but what they're talking about in Washington. I mean, Obama seems to be the only one who's, like, really into doing anything. Everyone else seems to be on their own little, we must fight this war agenda. And everyone else seems to not want it.
Jenny, thanks for the call, and good luck at work today. So what about it? Is there a disconnect, or how big a disconnect is there between all these people conducting these pseudo-debates in the media and what the average person actually thinks on the street?
I think there is quite a substantial gap. I probably personally do agree with Jenny that President Obama seems to be the only one who's talking about these things. But if we talk about the deficit, the economy, and all of those kinds of things, it doesn't help the Republican Party. We're still in a period where people can argue that this downturn in the economy, along with the excessive spending by the government, all began under a Republican administration. So the Republicans really don't want to raise that big an issue, and when it comes to bailing out corporations and so forth, the Bush administration actually started that. So I think the Republicans are finding it very difficult to attack in that area, and they've always been strong on national security. So that's where they're going. But Jenny is absolutely right that people on the streets have real concerns. And I do hope that we don't get all tangled up in some of these other issues. When people are losing jobs, when, you know, families can't, are losing their homes, when families are having difficulty supporting their families, just even going to the grocery store these days can be a really scary experience. And I don't think that a lot of people in Washington are as sensitive to that as perhaps they should be.
Well, you know, if you're worried about how you're going to make your next mortgage payment, it makes it a little harder to think in the abstract about winning the lottery type odds of being killed by a terrorist.
Right.
It really does. Let's see. Let's go to, I'll tell you what, let's go to Tim in Ladysmith next. Hi,
hey,
Tim. Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. Happy
you're
Memorial
welcome.
Day.
And do you?
I think a couple of things. I think the Democratic Party is kind of where the Republicans were a few years ago. If you recall, the Democratic Party a few years ago was everybody was asking, can they ever win another election? And so, you know, I think being the fact that the Democrats really don't have any more clue than the Republicans do, give them about a few years in power and the wheels will fall off as well, because I think where they're heading is going to be their own undoing. The other thing I'd like to comment on is I think we make a great mistake in marginalizing talk show hosts like Rush Limbaugh. I hear this constantly. Well, Rush Limbaugh is just an entertainer. He may be an entertainer, but he does speak the sentiments of many people who are very conservative in this country. And I kind of resent the fact that people like to say, well, let's just marginalize them, because that way people don't really take them seriously. And I do think you make a mistake when you act as if people like a talk show host like Rush Limbaugh, who is admired by millions of Americans, somehow does harm the Republican Party. It is the conservative base of the Republican Party that distinguishes it from the Democrats. And we don't want a liberal Republican Party. I mean, the Democrats are as liberal can be. And if we think that that is a turn-on to people of America, I think we make a great mistake. It is not conservatism that is destroying the Republican Party. It's their own stupidity and corruption. So thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call, Tim. Appreciate it. Well, I found someone as cynical as myself about political parties and their value, but Tim, striking a little bit of a chord there with the idea that, hey, Rush is speaking for a lot of really conservative people, and they believe what he says.
I think he not only speaks for a lot of people, but he also he is persuasive with a lot of people as well. One of the difficulties with Rush, however, is that he is capable of behavior that can be not just criticized, but ridiculed.
What about this whole, I guess one of the things that Tim brought up, and I want to get your take on this, Gloria, because this is something that's been on my mind as I've looked at our political scene. Man, how did we get to this where the only two things we can look at politically, you're either liberal or you're conservative? Where did that come from?
Well, we have this notion of a two-dimensional ideological spectrum. And I think most people are actually liberal on some, you know, it's actually multidimensional, and people might be liberal on some dimensions and conservative on others. So we really should be looking at this as multidimensional. I think if you try to force it into that two-dimensional continuum, what happens is to win you have to really be in the middle, but the middle can shift. And defining what is liberal or conservative in the American sense, is not that clear.
Well,
so,
just...
you know, the I think many Democrats are saying that Obama is not as liberal as people thought he was.
Well, he's a pragmatist.
Right.
I mean, he said so. He says, I believe in what works. That's the definition of pragmatism.
Correct.
And I think that's one thing a lot of people just haven't understood about Barack Obama from day one, is that he believes in things that work, and that's how he plans to run the government while he's the president. And so far, you can tell if it's working or not, I guess, because he's had both the left and the right angry at him simultaneously on the same issue.
And of course, that's kind of a dangerous position if the right and the left are both angry with you, even though that may be the middle ground.
Yeah, just for the record, I consider myself a radical moderate.
Yeah,
I'm starting a whole new ideological trend. You heard it here first on Wisconsin Public Radio: radical moderatism.
Right, and you know, a lot of this is jargon. What constitutes liberalism? I think if you try that in a classroom with students. For example, if you talk about some of the positions that are traditionally labeled as liberal, students don't necessarily label those as liberal. And the same thing with conservatism. And, you know, even with George Bush, who many of these people, you know, were so wild about supporting, yes, he was pro-life and things of that sort. But what was accomplished in terms of actual legislation and the courts and so forth under him, I think some of the pro-life people are very disturbed with that. If we talk about the economic conservatives, we hear them screaming right now about the domestic spending and how that has to be cut and so forth. But where were those folks when President Bush was spending just enormous amounts on the war in Iraq, much of this off budget. So,
yeah.
And the same thing with judicial activism. We hear this, Republican court is, Democrats are going to be choosing an activist judge. Well, I think there are activist judges who are liberal and activist judges who are conservative. We tend to attack the activist judges who take positions we don't like.
Yeah, I think there's a proverb here about whose ox is being gored or something like that.
Absolutely.
Okay, we've got more phone calls to take, and we have a break to get to, so let's take the break. We'll come back, and we'll take some more calls. There'll be a line opening shortly for you at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. It's all things political for Memorial Day 2009. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:45. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's coming up. Well, next hour I'll be talking to a guest who's the author of a book titled Life Lists, A Woman's Quest for the World's Most Amazing Birds. It's a really interesting story, and we'll be talking about that a little bit later today on Talk of the Nation. After one, caring for caregivers. As Lee Woodruff cared for her husband Bob after he suffered a traumatic brain injury in Iraq, one of the worst things was the uncertainty. This Memorial Day, Lee Woodruff joins us as we focus on caregivers. Talk of the Nation after 1 o'clock today here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's all things political. My guest is Gloria Toivola, who is professor and chair of the Department of Politics, Law, and Justice at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. Let's go to Zach in Green Bay next. Hi, Zach.
Thank you.
Thanks for holding.
Thank you. I wanted to express my really disgust with the gutlessness of Democrats in the Senate now on many issues. They seem to be folding and compromising at the drop of a hat. On energy issues, on mortgage issues, and especially on health care, where we have millions of Americans who have lost their homes because of medical bills. We have 40 million working Americans who have no coverage, and we pay six times as much in the administration of our health care system per person than do Europeans. Yet in the face of this, the Democrats have allowed single-payer universal to be taken off the table completely, and now it looks like they're not even going to allow for a government-run healthcare option as part of our new healthcare bill, and I think Senator Cole is one of those who needs to be contacted and talked to and asked whether he's a real Democrat or not.
Well, Zach, I'm glad you brought that up because I had a note here to mention that because that issue was the pretty much the entire focus of Bill Moyer's journal this past week. They had a quote from Senator Backus, who was being asked about why isn't single-payer universal health care on the table? Why isn't it being discussed? And his summation after he hemmed and hawed a little bit was basically you could never get it passed. But no one seems to be even interested in trying. Is single-payer dead?
Well, I think if we look at the behavior, Zach is quite correct. We seem to see Democrats running away from it. In a sense, they're falling into this notion of when it comes to domestic policy, that's where we need to watch the budget expenditures. And, you know, this is something that affects ordinary people. And it absolutely has to be addressed. When people lose their jobs, for example, you know, we're told, oh, well, there's the COBRA plan, you know, that you can stay on your insurance for a period of time.
Well, yeah, if you can afford it.
If you can afford it, that's correct. And, you know, I think if you have one of the very elaborate plans and you're talking about family coverage, you can be talking about $30,000 a year.
Well, and then, let's say you pay all that and you had a really good plan and so forth, you could still, you're one catastrophic illness away from being bankrupt.
Oh, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, if we look at who is going bankrupt, if we do look at who is really in trouble with those credit cards, it's people who have had a medical emergency. Now, Senator Backus is one of the you know, much more conservative Democrats. Not all Democrats are that wild about taking care of the health care plans. And you know, this is one of the places where I think we have to look at things like you know, the power of the health insurance companies.
Rarely, yeah, half a billion dollars spent lobbying every year.
Exactly, and you know, the fact of the matter is that is not an efficient system. Everyone seems to assume, and I think that we've been bamboozled into this viewpoint, that when government runs a program, it is inefficient. Now, there is no program that is more efficient than the Social Security Administration, run by the federal government. When you think about the number of people getting a check every single month, in other words, government can run these things efficiently. There would be one set of paperwork, you know, that, and you can have common standards. Right now, even choosing between these private insurers is absolutely insane. You can't figure out ahead of time what they are and are not going to cover. You know, the insurance companies make arguments. They've already, I've seen a few ads on, you know, how terrible the Canadian system is. Vast majority of Canadians do not agree with that position. We're hearing how much it's going to cost. I personally get very frustrated with the notion that when we talk about something that is going to help ordinary people, why is it that we talk, the first thing that comes out of our mouth is the cost? When we talk about a war, we don't want to talk about the cost of it. And to me, this is insane. I guess, you know, maybe on my own personal views are really coming out here, but it would seem that a government's first obligation is to its people. And right now, people need help when it comes to health care. But I think your caller is quite correct that people are backing off. Now, the only way we're going to see a change in this is to see massive numbers of individuals absolutely demanding it.
Well, there's starting to be some demonstrations and so forth. You've got a lot of nurses and a lot of doctors who basically are no longer in private practice. They work for corporations and get a paycheck.
Exactly. And they're told that they can or cannot use a particular procedure by an insurance company.
Yeah, and the insurance companies are not in the business of saying yes.
No, they're in the business of making money.
They collect premiums and they make a bet that you won't get sick.
And one of the advantages, of course, of a universal program would be that if you have everybody in the program, that means you have some people that are going to be very expensive, who have significant health problems, and other people who are younger or perhaps just don't have the same kind of medical problems. Otherwise, if you have just the government program as an option, what you're going to have is people self-select with severe medical problems, self-selecting into that government program, and it's going to cost more.
Here's an email from Tina in Stevens Point about health care. She says, didn't Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, of course, didn't Pelosi say that a single-payer national health care system is impractical? What makes it impractical, and what is really behind the blackout on even discussing it in D.C.? Who are the players involved in keeping it off the table?
Well, I clearly think it's the large insurance companies. You know, they even argue today that they employ so many people that we'd have massive unemployment if somehow the insurance companies went out of business. So, you know, they have these politicians all twisted around.
Well, hospitals could certainly hire more nursing staff if they didn't have to have so many clerks taking care of all the insurance paperwork.
Well, certainly. And, you know, we hear today about the shortage of nurses, and yet we find hospitals not wanting to hire nurses. They want to hire cheaper nurse practitioners or whatever. That's what the real demand is. And so it is a convoluted system that is predicated on the notion that a private corporation, a private profit-seeking institution has to be in charge of our health care. If you look at the rest of the world, we stand out as being very unusual in that perspective.
Let's take a quick call from Steve in Milwaukee, who wants to shift our focus a little bit back to the Supreme Court, kind of where we started. Steve, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, John, Professor. Happy Memorial Day.
And to you.
I have a question about the Supreme Court and the potential nomination. And, you know, I'm 56. I'm a bright guy. But what I can't understand is the fact that when they talk about interpreting, you know, having a justice that won't interpret the Constitution according to their own ideologies, number one, we're all the product of our ideology, our experience, our the sum total of our lives come to bear on who we are. So obviously when people make decisions, they have to make it based on, you know, their personalities in a sense. But the other thing I don't understand is when people talk about faithfully interpreting the Constitution, how can we not take into account the modern day world? I mean, back when the Constitution was written, there was not automatic weapons or technology, airplanes, medically safe abortions. And so, you know, I don't understand that. And again, I consider myself a bright person, but I don't know how you cannot interpret the Constitution in a modern way of thinking, you know, because more conservative people want to stay based on how it was written. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think we do, Gloria.
Yes.
Okay.
I think if we didn't have interpretation to adapt the Constitution to the modern day and to the modern, you know, the modern technological world and the rest of it, we'd have to throw out the Constitution. Because if you compare the federal Constitution to the state constitutions, you'll find that state constitutions are very, very specific and they're very, very long. Because they're specific, they're amended all over the place. Now, that means that they don't lead to interpretation. So, actually many state constitutions have been totally replaced. So the federal constitution is a fairly brief document in comparison to state constitutions. And it is not specific enough to tell us exactly how to interpret it. And that's, in a sense, the beauty of the federal constitution, in that its vagueness, in a sense, it allows for this interpretation, which allows us to keep this as a continuing document. And so that, I think, is the genius of the federal Constitution. And, you know, when it comes to specific interpretation, I don't know that that's always possible. I think when people say they're interpreting the Constitution specifically, they are nevertheless putting their own interpretation into it.
Well, we all have our own built-in biases and values and so forth, and that affects everything that that we say and think and do, and sometimes we try to ignore that. But at any rate, we're about out of time. We managed to fill up an entire hour again. Thank you so much, Gloria, for being my guest this morning. It's always a pleasure to talk politics with you, and I hope we get to do it again.
Okay, you're welcome.
Try and enjoy the rest of your Memorial Day holiday. I appreciate you being here today. Gloria Toivola is a professor and chair of the Department of Politics, Law, and Justice at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. She joined us by telephone from her home near Duluth today. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. On-air production today from John Treader. The program itself, if you missed the beginning of it and want to go back and hear it again, you can do that by going to our website, WPR.org. You can listen to the whole thing again, or you can go to the radio store and purchase a copy. Call 800-747-7444 and ask for program 522D. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.